station, shipping company, grocery store, restaurant, a foghorn.
A foghorn? What kind of mythical beast is that?
A foghorn!
Where's that in Greek mythology? Right next to the chimera.
Did Odysseus fight that?
That's not how I was supposed to say that.
Nope.
And spiritual guide Sean Barber. I'm joined as always by our resident expert in death, Miss Nicole Jewett.
Hello.
And the man who knows nothing, Mr. Ethan Black.
Why'd you change my title back?
Because I run this show.
Okay.
And I choose what titles people get.
That's fair enough, I guess.
Now, this week we're getting to a topic that I'm a little surprised we haven't talked about before. It's cults. We're finally doing
it.
It
seems like
episode.
Really low hanging fruit that we just haven't, like, We're too main, not mainstream.
Yeah,
for us.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Cults are just a little too mainstream for us. So we decided to pick a couple that I haven't really heard anybody discuss that much before. Like these, I've never really heard of these cults before. So I'm
and
hoping,
one is right here in Connecticut, like
very close to home. So the three that we're going to be talking about is an MLM cult called Nexium, the All American Alamo Christian Foundation, and a real estate company run by Jesus himself.
Excuse me?
Did you know that?
Oh yeah.
Did they ever teach you that in church, that Jesus has a construction company?
You know, we never went over that chapter of the Bible.
Been sleeping through that, because that's pretty damn important, I'm pretty
sure. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, one would assume so.
All right, this is a long episode, so no bullshit. We're just going to get right into it. We've got three wacky cults, three dumbass hosts, and no fucking clue what we're doing. This is Rule of Three. Our first story of the day is about a cult founded near where I grew up in Clifton Park, New York. And this one, honestly, it's gotta be out of some bullshit fiction novel because it's insane. There's famous actors, millions of dollars, sex slaves, and Seagrams of all things.
Seagrams, like the drink company?
Yes, the drink company Seagrams.
They got
like
really good. They got really good drinks on them, Seagrams.
They got really good money, too, apparently.
I mean, is this
and
the
really
Illuminati?
Good sex cults.
I said, is this the Illuminati? Because you're talking about famous people and Seagrams now. I don't know.
I feel like a lot of these cults are just famous people.
What if all cults are just like subsections of the Illuminati?
I feel like
that's also like a conspiracy.
I feel like a lot of them try to imitate like the secrecy of the Illuminati. Because, okay.
That's true.
The appeal of a lot of cults is some lonely... We're going to get into this.
It's community.
How all of these cults essentially are some lonely... nerd virgin
with a god complex
and charisma like Hitler
with a ton of charisma who just wants friends and pussy.
Yeah,
and that's pretty much it. And
the
they want to be cool. They want to be a badass. And so they hear about the Illuminati and all these secret societies. And,
they
want to
be
oh,
in on it.
Oh, yeah. That's going to be me.
It's pretty baller. I mean, awful things happen on there. But like, when it comes down to the motivation and determination, you got to give them props.
Yeah. No, I mean, you got to hustle for a cult. You got to hustle
you
for
do.
A cult.
That's true. And you have to be like very charismatic in order to get... all of these people to believe you, especially like it's one
really
thing if you're like super charismatic and you say the sky is blue. It's another thing if you're talking about the wacky shit that these people talk about and people still believe you because you're just that good.
Yeah. So the whole story of Nexium really starts with one man named Keith Raniere. Raniere was born in Brooklyn, New York on August 26, 1960, but his family relocated a little north to Suffern, New York when he was five. Raniere's family, admittedly, was a little bit fucked up. His father, James, worked for an advertising company and was rarely around, and his mother, Vera, was both a professional dancer and a professional alcoholic. By the time he was 8 years old, his parents split, leaving Raniere, who was an only child, very alone most of the time.
Oof. Not good. That's when you get up to some shit.
Yeah. His life didn't get much better at school, where he reportedly didn't make many friends, and most people seemed to not know that he existed.
Me too, buddy.
That's
to make up for the lack of a social life, Keith buried himself in books and started with some of the more interesting authors of the 20th century.
I thought you were just going to end up buried himself, and I was like, me too.
He buried himself.
He like ostriched himself and just like, boom, right in the ground.
Ostriched himself.
Most teenagers would have read some adventure or love novels. Like
I read Twilight when I was a teenager.
Somebody should have given him Magic Treehouse, and we would have solved a lot of problems.
Those books really got you in your feel sometimes. They were
Civil
great.
Civil War on Wednesday.
But Keith found a different calling, which would set up the foundation for his later role as a cult leader.
Spoiler alert.
Among the authors that he enjoyed, there was L. Ron Hubbard, the leader of Scientology, Ayn Rand, who argued that capitalism should rule all, and basically, you should die if you weren't tough enough.
You snowflake.
And Aleister Crowley, who believed that a failed sex magic ritual had caused World War I.
A failed sex magic?
Okay,
I know you said you weren't going to tell this story, but please tell this story.
Yeah, what does that mean?
So basically, if you don't know, this show was heavily inspired by the last podcast on the left, and they just recently finished up a series on Aleister Crowley. So that's how I know all of this. So Aleister Crowley was a practicing magician in the early 1900s, right?
Like Houdini magician.
No. Like ritual magic.
Oh, magician. Like witch doctor.
Oh,
type
yeah.
Like pentagram. Gotcha.
Yeah. Like, he believed in, like, magic rituals and
like
stuff.
Like Houdini.
And he genuinely believed he was this powerful. And so he had, like, his little right-hand man who would do anything he said.
Igor?
And so he set this guy up with a wife and everything. And they were pretty happy together. But Aleister also liked to completely fuck with everybody in his life. And so he created this sex magic ritual that they had to perform, him, his sidekick, and the sidekick's wife. And he was railing the fuck out of the sidekick's wife for this ritual.
A cock.
And the other guy was supposed to come, like jizz everywhere. But he didn't because his wife was getting railed by Aleister Crowley.
Yeah, by the homie.
And not That's him.
And so because he didn't jizz, the ritual failed, and soon after, World War I began. So Aleister Crowley believed that his failed sex magic ritual started World War I.
You know, I'm sure you could find evidence to support that claim.
It makes perfect sense when you put it like that.
These are the influences that young Keithy is reading up on.
And you wonder why he turned out the way he did.
That's crazy.
Just
dude.
Looking at these three influences here, you can start to paint a pretty clear picture of what his belief system would be. Essentially, a cult of money and sex where the strongest man himself should rule them all. During his time in high school, Keith's mother, Vera, became very sick, and he spent 5 years of his life caring for her, knowing that she could die at any moment. On top of that, he also found his way into drinking and drugs, which certainly didn't help his mental state. After graduating from high school, Keith attended Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, or RPI, and he did terribly there. At the time that he graduated, Keith had a whopping 2.26 GPA, and
not
he had failed most of his upper-level courses.
Better than a 2.24.
That's true.
That's true.
Empirically.
Exactly.
The funny thing is about this is that, like, he genuinely had a god complex. Like, he thought he was great, and so he was going around, like, bragging to everybody about how well he was doing and how, like, he was taking all these really impressive upper-level math courses, but he was bombing the fuck out of them. Yeah. So, like, is that really all that impressive?
That's why he said taking, not passing.
Yeah, true.
Or
he was indeed enrolled in the classes, yes.
More concerningly, though, this was also the time that Keith Raniere started many abusive relationships. At a theater class he attended, which should be a red flag, first of all, if you are like...
He's a theater nerd.
Theater kids.
If you're in your mid-20s attending a local theater class... Ask yourself
with
some
what
questions.
We will soon find out is young people.
Yeah.
Like, this was not a theater class meant for adults, yeah. I'm
Stop
guessing.
Stop hitting it with that hard young.
So at the theater class that he was attending, the 24-year-old Keith started up a relationship with 15-year-old Gina Melita, and he later began raping her.
I'm just going to say this right now, Ethan. If you're going to be grossed out by young people involved in relationships, this is not the right episode for you, my friend.
It's just like, come on, son. Like, no, you don't have to.
Yeah. Now, this continued for a little while until he met Gina Hutchinson, who was also 15 years old, and he raped and sexually assaulted her as well.
Were they in a relationship first or not? Not that it matters, I'm just curious.
Whatever relationship they were in, he's 24, these girls are 15.
But it wasn't like...
He was probably just, like, grooming them and saying
exactly.
that they were
I'm
wonderful.
Sure, like, he had a relationship with them, but it was basically he was grooming them to be sex slaves.
Well, I just wasn't sure if you meant, like, he was still dating the one Gina, and then he saw the other Gina and was like, boom, one off and done.
Yeah, I don't really know, but basically...
This is like his unfortunate cultivation.
Yeah, this was just him kind of testing his powers as a charismatic person and learning that he could use his...
He could manipulate people really well.
He could use himself to get what he wanted, and that was sex.
Who would have thought you could manipulate young people who don't know that much about trust and
everything? My God.
Young, naive girls who think that you're great.
During all of these relationships, Keith was a complete egomaniac, even acting like he was a god and that these women were lucky to be with him. He would constantly manipulate them, lying about how much he loved them, and he even called Gina Hutchinson a Buddhist goddess.
Now think about this. Imagine you're a 15-year-old girl, starstruck and in love, and you're...
Your 24-year-old boyfriend
calls you a Buddhist goddess. Probably feels pretty good.
Hang on, though, because I'm not sure how much of a compliment you should take that as. Because have you seen, like, Hindu and Buddhist goddesses? They've, like, blue and got, like, six arms and, like, four tits.
Maybe you want to be that.
Frankly, I would not mind having six arms.
And that four tits?
Well, maybe not
like
that
Harry
part.
Styles.
What?
He has four nipples.
Doesn't he have three nipples?
Four.
Four now?
Yeah.
Damn.
He didn't grow another one. He's always had four.
I swear he only had three at some point. This man's hacking.
After college, Keith began his long streak of working for and creating pyramid schemes, starting with Amway in the 1980s.
If you don't know, Amway is an MLM company that sells health and beauty products and has been investigated dozens of times in multiple countries, but has managed to evade being shut down as a pyramid scheme so far. So as Sean was explaining to me the other night, it's really hard to prove a pyramid scheme.
Oh, yeah.
They have to hit like certain, because you might think like those exist all the time, like now.
And MLMs do exist everywhere. Yeah. But the issue is that you have to legally prove that it's a pyramid scheme. And so the way that
and
that
that's a little more tricky.
Is you need to prove that like the vast majority of income that a person can make working there comes from recruiting others.
Oh.
But if you manage to twist your revenue data, you can be like, oh, well, they make most of their money from selling products, not from recruiting people. Or, you know, like, it's more expensive to recruit people, so they're not really making that much money. So this actually makes more money than recruiting. And so if you cook the books really well, it's hard to prove that it's a pyramid scheme.
Which is why they still exist.
Damn, I love lying. It's great.
Legally lying.
So fantastic.
So Amway was also founded by Richard DeVos, whose son, Dick DeVos, would marry Betsy DeVos, which is just kind of a little fun fact.
Dick DeVos.
Dick DeVos.
That is kind of an unfortunate
name. It's a funny name.
Keith worked there for most of the 1980s and then moved on to form his own MLM company in 1990 called Consumers Byline Incorporated, or CBI, which I was thinking when I was like reading this, of course you want to start a pyramid scheme.
Yeah.
The person at the top
if
gets the most money.
If you're at the top of it, you are cashing
in. You're getting
in.
Money from everyone. While the business seemed to be fairly successful for a few years, growing to over 250,000 members and earning $33 million, by 1993, Keith was being sued for running a pyramid scheme, and CBI was officially shut down in 1996.
And I think this also just goes to prove like the power of these pyramid schemes is he started this business in 1990. By 1993, he had 250,000 members and $33 million.
Well, yeah, because if you think about it, like one person can recruit three people. And then those three people recruit three people. And now you have, like, I guess 10 because you started with one.
Yeah.
So that's how fast it grows because everybody knows three people they can recruit.
Yeah.
And then you start to branch out from the social circles. And so eventually you get to people that original person didn't know.
But
all the recruits has reached that broad of an audience.
Yeah. It's like rabbits.
Kind of. However, the next chapter of Keith's life had already begun. It was at CBI that he met a woman named Toni Natalie, who was married at the time, but she soon left her husband and moved to Clifton Park to be with Keith.
Just had to get some of that Keith in her life.
Piece of Keith.
The two of them started an MLM multivitamin business called the National Health Network in 1994, but that failed 5 years later. Keith wasn't done, though, and he decided to give MLMs one more shot, this time with some inspiration from his favorite authors, who we talked about as being pretty fucked up people. Around 1998, Keith and Toni began recruiting for the early stages of what would become Nexium, allegedly an executive training and self-help program, but for the few on the inside, it was a sinister cult dealing in sex and death.
I would just like to pause for a second and just tell you that Nexium, by the way, is spelled NXIVM in all capitals. just in case you needed any more proof that this was
dope as fuck,
a complete
name.
Virgin loser who just wanted to be cool.
Yeah,
it's like Nexium.
It reminds me of
it's a gamer tag.
That episode we did on like the conspiracies, like Titan Point,
oh, yeah.
and Skid Row,
and wait for video
and
games,
lithium.
Because you're right, he was actually heavily inspired by video games,
no.
and that was like a core part of his belief system in the cult.
And we'll talk about that in a little bit.
Little stability plus video games is not great. And I love games, but if you're not stable and you look at a game and you're like, that's cool, I want to do that in real life, seek help.
Also, the other thing from our Team Edward episode, one of those vampire cults was based on Vampire the Gathering. Like,
yeah.
that was his, I think that's what it was called.
Yeah,
don't quote me on
like that. Yeah.
But that was his like main inspiration, was this video game where like you were a vampire.
Also, for any FBI agents listening, be on the lookout for Ethan Black's own cult coming in about 5 years' time.
No.
An unstable individual who loves video games? What? Where would you find one of those?
I'm not that charismatic. Come on now.
That's a good point. Tony Natalie met Nancy Salzman, who quickly became obsessed with Keith and helped him build his network of clients and victims. From here, the story gets a little complicated. So there are two distinct sides of Nexium, the real business side and the cult side, because of course you have to have the cover for what you're doing
yeah.
behind the scenes.
Yeah.
On the business side, Nexium operated as a self-help program, holding events like executive retreats. They had thousands of legitimate clients and held seminars all over the country, and at first glance, this was just another one of Keith's bullshit business ventures. Looking a little bit deeper, though, Nexium had a very dark side. One of the things that tipped off a lot of people was the strange names that Keith and Nancy would go by. During their seminars, Keith would be referred to as Vanguard, a nod to his favorite arcade game, and Nancy was called Prefect. In order to take a class, the members had to pay thousands of dollars, which obviously got them invested in the program because they didn't want to lose their money.
Mm-hmm. Well, once you've already put that much money into it, you don't want to look like the idiot who wasted thousands of dollars.
Kind of like when you go to college.
Oof.
That's unfortunate.
And you
all
don't
right,
want to drop right. out even though you think you might not be cut out for this because
right.
you already wasted thousands of dollars.
Swiftly getting away from that.
All of the members of this, dare I say, cult, had to wear very different colored sashes during the seminars that would correspond to a rank, and Keith wore a long white sash,
and so
like a bride.
The idea is that you wanted to hook these people into coming again and again and again to the seminars. You wanted them to constantly be
immersed
in this world.
So they got to change
world.
Their sash. It's
exactly.
kind of like karate belts.
I was thinking that, but reverse.
You keep going until you get the highest belt.
Because white's the highest belt. In cult terms.
In,
that's true.
In Keithland.
In Keithland.
Nexium.
Vanguard land. The crucial part of these seminars, though, the real kicker, was that the members were required to share very intimate details of their lives, which helped Keith kind of lure them in
dirt.
And keep them stuck because he had dirt on
Hit
them.
Him
he
with
could
that
blackmail,
blackmail
them. There was another level to the weirdness of Nexium, and this is where the cult truly begins.
This shit's an onion.
It's got
yeah,
layers.
No kidding.
We got layers on
we
layers.
We got layers to this shit.
Beneath the business side existed a group called The Vow, made up of women extremely devoted to Keith.
You know where this is going.
A large part of their role was scouting out other women to bring to Keith, often for sexual exploitation.
Recruiting, just like MLMs.
That makes sense.
In this regard, Nexium was heavily involved in sex trafficking, and Keith Raniere had managed to get a lot of very rich and famous women to do it for him. Some of the people involved included actress Allison Mack, daughter of Seagram's owner Claire and Sarah Bronfman, who invested millions into Nexium.
Oh, come on,
like,
Seagram's.
Yeah.
Stupid money. Stupid money. Like, their money kept this going.
Yeah.
Like, without, Keith's GPA amount of money.
Yeah, without...
stupid money.
Without college kids everywhere buying Seagram's, this would have gone
under. This cult maybe never would have happened.
And actress Kristen Kruick, among many, many others. Members of The Vow had to give up damaging information about themselves, including nude photos as collateral, ensuring that they would never leave the fold of the cult.
Because now they got your nudies, you're stuck.
For their initiation, women would be held down in the basement of Nancy Salzman's house and branded with a symbol that incorporated Keith Raniere's initials. Once
yeah.
a member of The Vow, the women were like slaves to Keith, performing sexual acts for him and devoting their entire lives to the cult. All of their time was basically spent networking with other people to get the cult more influence, recruiting more women to be a part of The Vow. and raising money for it. Like, that's what their lives entirely became. Like, these actresses quit their jobs, like their successful acting careers, and became part of this cult. They just left.
Like, that's nutty, dude.
It's insane.
What cologne was he using?
Axe, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Anyone that tried to leave or criticize Nexium was met with the cunning social side of the cult, which had a lot of important connections with lawmakers and social media outlets. And this story is fucking crazy. Keith managed to set up an event with the Dalai Lama in Albany.
Yeah.
Even though there were already tons of rumors about what was going on with Nexium. Like, people knew that there was something
happening. Damn well could have looked into this.
Yeah, but he didn't care. He's like, let's go.
He managed to get the fucking Dalai Lama to come in for, like, an executive training program.
That's kind of dope.
Nuts.
Hold on. What kind of executive training does the Dalai Lama need?
No, he was like a guest there.
Okay. I was like, wait a minute.
Can you imagine, Keith? Hey, yo, Dalai Lama, you suck ass. Come to the seminar.
Come learn from me.
We'll teach you more things. And he's like, yeah, I got you.
Okay, makes sense.
Humbling, Keith. Thank you. I'll accept your invitation.
Now, it was no secret that Nexium was involved in some shady practices, and multiple sources, including the New York Times, Forbes, and a local paper, the Times Union, had been reporting on the group since its inception. However, it was in 2017 when Keith's empire began to collapse under the scrutiny.
Can I interrupt real quick? That's one of my favorite phrases in anything that has to do with anything that's not okay, is it's a well-known fact that insert people were doing terrible things, and then no one does shit about it. It's one of my favorite phrases, because it's like, what do you mean? Like, it's, huh?
Well, the issue is that anytime somebody would publish something about the cult,
they get blackmailed.
They would go after them.
Oh, it makes sense, but if everyone knows about it, you'd think that, like, you could rally
you
a bunch
of... the police would be useful and try to stop this?
You'd think that, I don't know, like, someone would do something. You would hope, at least.
You would think.
Well,
would
I mean, any time, like, somebody would publish an article, they'd go after them and discredit all of their work and make it seem like they were just some, like, crackhead trying to get a little bit of fame and attention off of breaking a crazy case. Like, they would be able to ruin people's lives and careers that came after Nexium. That's
Clout
how strong
chasers.
They were.
Coming for their Nexium. There it is. There it was. There it registers. I was like, all right, there it is.
So in 2017, the New York Times, New York Post, Times Union, ABC, and A&E all released exposés on the organization. And soon after, Keith Raniere was arrested in Mexico. Many people in the organization faced charges in court over the next few years. Nancy Salzman and Allison Mack both pled guilty to racketeering criminal conspiracy, and Keith Raniere was found guilty of sex trafficking, racketeering, and forced labor conspiracy, and he will serve 120 years in prison.
How's he making out on that sentence? Do we know?
This was recent, like 20.
Yeah, that was in 2017.
So 2017 is when he was arrested.
Yeah.
The trials for Nancy Salzman and Allison Mack got delayed because of COVID.
So this man's has been hustling since I've been born and
this
in high
just
school.
Happened.
Yeah.
Actually, crazy thing. All of these stories like,
are fairly
just
recent.
Happened.
Yeah. Well, if you think about it, I mean, I guess there were like cults in the olden days, but especially now with like the rise of the internet and like. Global communication being like right in the palm of your hand,
Yeah. It's
really easy for them to have more influence than ever.
That's
yeah,
true.
And I mean, when it comes to cult history too, there are a couple like booms of cults in America.
Yeah.
Like right after World War II, all these soldiers were coming back with all these experiences in like Eastern countries and in foreign cultures. And so they had all of these like new cultural ideas that they were bringing back
to
America.
That wasn't really common knowledge all
exactly.
over the world. Like you weren't educated about other people's cultures
and
before
so
recently.
In the 1950s, we saw a huge boom of cults. Like Scientology was probably the biggest one to come out of that era, where people were looking for like alternative medicine and alternative science and things like that. And so they got really invested in that. Then we hit the Cold War and the Red Scare. And so that was like America, 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 and
yeah,
all that shit
capitalism.
Stopped. But then we hit the Vietnam War. And then again, people are starting to think, well, maybe America's not so great. What are some alternatives? And so again, they start looking towards Eastern medicine and alternative medicine and things like that. And that's when we get a second boom. And then we're going to read about it with the Alamo Christian Foundation. And The Work Call is the last story of the day. Both of those started in the 70s during that boom period once again. And then now, like Nicole was just saying, we have the internet where it's so easy to get people to believe things.
Yeah.
And so it's...
You don't just have to, like, have a meeting and rely on people showing
up. Yeah.
You put your information out there for anyone to find, and whoever stumbles upon it and gets, like, enveloped in it, that just happens. And you put no effort into recruiting that person.
Oh, yeah,
they
exactly.
found it all
so
on their
easy,
own. They came to you.
Yeah. So that's all we've got on Nexium. Hopefully we don't get murdered by Keith Raniere anytime soon.
Nah, he's in jail.
And we're going to take a
is
quick
he?
Little break. Yeah, he's in jail. I hope so.
But is he,
as
though?
Far as we know.
That's what I'm saying. You think he is, but like, what if that's a Keith dummy?
When we come back, we're going to discuss Tony Alamo in some very stylish denim jackets. The story of the Alamo Christian Foundation is really the story of two pathological liars, Bernie Hoffman and Edith Horn. Now, the two of them had completely different upbringings, born in different areas of the country, whatever. But by the 1960s, they had each made their way to Hollywood at the height of the Flower Child movement. Bernie was there trying to make it as a pop singer, going by the name Mark Hoffman.
Because how many pop singers do you know named Bernie?
Bernie.
I am one.
You just
again.
Wait for Bernie Sanders to drop his mixtape.
I was going
right.
to say.
If he can't be president, maybe he can be a pop princess. I don't know.
This man's walking around like, I am now again asking for you to listen to my mixtape, please.
But his career wasn't all that successful, and he started looking for a little side hustle to make some extra money. Edith also had dreams of being a star, and she went to Hollywood in search of a career as an actress, but she too failed. So Edith began frequenting local churches with her daughter, and together they told stories about finding God through their travels abroad, which, for the record, never happened at all.
Yep.
None of that
That's
was true.
Great.
Figured.
This worked quite well for them, though, and one day Bernie happened to stumble across them. While he wasn't all too talented himself, Bernie did know talent when he saw it. And after watching Edith captivate the church audiences, he knew he could make something out of it.
He knew she was full of shit.
There was one
oh, yeah.
little issue with the two of them going around and spreading the good Christian word, though. Neither of them were Christian. In fact, they were both Jewish.
You mean to tell me that Bernie is Jewish?
So to overcome this slight little detail, they did some good old all-American rebranding. In 1966, Bernie and Edith went to Las Vegas, got married, and took the names Tony and Susan Alamo.
How much
wow.
more American could you get, except that they have, like, a Labrador named Hamburger?
David Crockett is rolling in his grave right
Davy
now.
Davy Crockett.
Is that his name, Danny Crockett? Who the hell
no,
was that?
It's Davy Crockett.
You got it
right. was Davy Crockett.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
I thought you said Danny. I was like, huh?
No.
Danny Phantom?
Johnny Baseball. Tony and Susan returned to Hollywood and claimed to be born-again Christians. Together, they started preaching a very apocalyptic version of Christianity, similar to what we would later see from the Branch Davidians in Waco. At the time, Hollywood was full of young people dropping acid and looking for some big meaning in life, and the Alamos certainly provided that. In 1969, the Alamo Christian Foundation was officially created, and they soon gathered a large following of vulnerable youths who they actively took advantage of.
Is anybody noticing a pattern here by any chance?
I'll take vulnerable youths for 2000, Alex.
I'm going to take
RIP Alex
police?
Trebek, all the respect in the world.
Yeah.
Eventually, the pair got successful enough to build their own church about half an hour outside of LA. Right off the bat, though, there were some serious warning signs of what was about to come. On one hand, the members of the Alamo Christian Foundation were treated all right. The Alamos would drive people out to their church and give them dinner and a place to stay, but they would also make their members stand out on the Walk of Fame and pester random people all day to hand out pamphlets.
You know, like those people that like just stand out there, like if you've ever been to New York or anything, like you see the people just holding pamphlets like all
or
day.
Or the people in Vegas who like give out the prostitute cards.
and the issue is that this is LA and like the middle of summer. And so it is scorching hot, and they're out here all day,
cooking.
All day, trying to recruit people, trying to find more recruits, essentially. That's what they were doing.
Yeah. That reminds me of when I had to ring the bell for the Salvation Army when I was a cheerleader in high school, and it was like negative 20 degrees with wind chill. Let me tell you, that's not a fun experience. This would be only the first example of the forced labor that Tony Alamo would become infamous for. By 1971, their church in Agua Dulce was complete, and a larger compound started to grow around it. In total, the Alamos bought the surrounding 12 acres to build up many buildings, turning the church into a fully livable area. Expansion continued as the Alamos gained more followers, and in 1976, they moved to Susan's hometown of Dyer, Arkansas, which is quite a change.
Dyer. That's a jump.
L.A. to Arkansas, that's a lot.
She's getting homesick, maybe.
That's true. It's worth mentioning that the Alamo Christian Foundation actually received a lot of national attention, including a commendation from the then California governor, Ronald Reagan. On the surface, this group was doing a lot of good work, helping drug addicts and the homeless find refuge and spreading good Christian gospel, but not all was what it seemed on the inside.
Shocker.
When we were researching this story, I ran into two very distinct factions about the Alamo Christian Foundation. On one hand, it was the people who said, these were great people doing God's
work,
helping drug addicts. And yes, that is true.
Again,
on one hand,
the cover-up for the shitty stuff they were doing underneath.
That part of it is true. And they think all the people that call this a cult is just like they're a bunch of conspiracy theorists and they're just trying to shut down Christianity and whatnot. And for those people that have those beliefs, I'm sure that is scary because you don't want to believe
they've
that.
Done something good for them. And so they want to think that
exactly.
was actually a good thing. Like it doesn't have an ulterior motive.
And you don't want to think that these people that are spreading ideas that you agree with that in their essence are good ideas could ever do something evil. But you have to face the reality that they did. And we'll get into the stuff that they did. And it is hard to believe sometimes, like the stuff that these people really did. But it's true. And you have to face the reality of that. Now, just like they did in California, the foundation constructed a complex around the church. But this one was even larger, more like a small town. Their grounds consisted of the church, a gas station, shipping company, grocery store, restaurant, a foghorn.
A foghorn? What kind of mythical beast is that?
A foghorn!
A foghorn!
Where's that in Greek mythology? Right next to the chimera.
Did Odysseus fight that?
The hog farm! Bunkhouses,
schools... Do you just want to redo this
no,
one?
No, that's
okay.
bad, no. Schools, printing shops, and famously, factories where Tony Alamo produced his designer denim jacket.
Are you serious?
The fog farm is still killing me.
This guy made an entire town. That's
no,
crazy.
He did. And the point of it was to
be self-sufficient,
recruit people, and keep them there. He didn't want people to have to leave for
to need
any
anything
reason.
Except from him.
Exactly. Now, the jackets that Tony Alamo produced were very intricate.
Yes,
and
they were.
They sold them to big-time celebrities, including Elvis Presley,
Kanye,
Bruce Springsteen, James Brown, and Michael Jackson, who wore his Tony Alamo jacket on the album cover for Bad. You know, like that black leather
jacket?
That's a Tony Alamo. I'm not kidding. That jacket, possibly his most famous album, he's wearing... A slave labor jacket, essentially.
You know, from the controversies...
If he wasn't already dead, he'd probably get canceled for that.
Michael?
Yeah.
I mean, he was already canceled before that. You know what I mean? The other
that's true for touching kids. You're right.
Kind of the least of
Michael
Jackson's issues. Not
confirmed, but highly suggested.
Yeah, you're right.
The jackets gained Tony a lot of fame and also started bringing in the money, nearly $60 million.
Well, I'm sure he wasn't selling them for like $12 at Walmart.
Yeah.
He was probably selling them for like thousands of dollars to big-time celebrities.
And just like any good businessman, Tony wanted to find ways to not have to pay taxes on his income.
Of course.
And in 1982, he reformed the Alamo Christian Foundation into the Music Square Church, or MSC, and was granted tax-exempt status as a nonprofit organization.
It's almost like churches probably shouldn't be tax-exempt organizations because
almost.
It leaves them as prey to things like this.
And there's one slight problem with being a nonprofit organization. The MSC was most definitely making a profit and a lot of it. Now, there are two main ways of increasing revenue in the business world. You can either sell your products for more or you make them for less. Now, Tony Alamo did both of these by selling his jackets for ridiculous amounts and produced them to next to nothing by paying his followers exactly $0 for all of their work. They got paid nothing. As a matter of fact, no one living on the compound made any money at all, even those that had outside jobs.
I have a quick question for you in that regard. If they made no money, either on the compound or off, how did they afford to live? Like, did the Alamo Foundation give them the money to live?
That was the point of living on the compound, is everything was provided for
them. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, it's kind of like here on campus.
But it kind of is like it is like living on a campus where essentially they don't have, the members living there don't have any money. They just get given things.
You get privileges.
And so they have no financial freedom at all. They are entirely controlled.
So they can't leave because they don't have
their
own income.
Exactly.
Take the vulnerable and expedite their dependence.
Where's that from?
Nowhere. I just made that up right
now.
An Ethan Black original.
Very smart.
Well, I mean, it's how you, it's just, dude, it's like, that's why you understand why, like, when you always are like, oh, you'll never believe what happened here. And I'm like, oh, they scalped them for fun. And you're like, what? It's pretty easy to think about how shitty people are going to be, which is very cynical. I don't mean to
be
a depressing Debbie.
The only thing that upsets me is when you get the really weird specific details correct before I've even said anything.
Thank Criminal Minds for that, because it really opened my doors onto what people are
all
capable
the possibilities.
Of. Even though it's fake. There is an episode, completely unrelated, and I'm on a tangent right now. There's an episode where a guy took human beings who were alive, and he turned them into puppets, the one I showed you.
Oh, yeah, that was fucked up.
Dislocating their joints. Once I saw that episode, it really just kind of kicked right in the basement door of fucking.
There were no limits anymore.
Really just kind of like.
In the basement door of fucking.
You really got no limits when you're a psychopath.
But that was the point of the whole compound. And a lot of people applauded that, saying, oh, all these people are provided for.
Yeah, they're being taken care of.
You're missing the fact that they are working very hard, but then being given things that are
disproportionate to the amount of work they're doing to
earn
them.
If they were just keeping the money that they were earning, they could have lived much better than they were. They were living in these bunkhouses that had no plumbing.
Yeah.
Nothing. Their standard of living was way below what it should have been for the amount of work that they were doing.
So I gotta make sure people's self-worth is lower than it should be. Because that's how you can get them to agree to things
like
living in situations.
Yeah.
Now, every penny that was made by the grocery store, the restaurant, or the Jacka sales, anything at all, was given directly to Tony and Susan, who used it to fund their operations. Now, a lot of their operations were in good spirits, as they genuinely did set up drug rehab programs and built community centers all over the South.
You gotta throw them off your trail by doing some good.
All of the funds were coming from slave labor. And that's just the truth of it. All of it was coming from exploited people. Life on the compound was even more controlling than that, as the Alamos believed in strict physical punishment, even for small children, and tightly regulated what was taught in their schools. Because remember, they built their own schools, so any of the children there...
And they were probably private schools, they didn't have to adhere to, like, government standards or anything.
Oh, completely, yeah. They decided what was taught. It was completely their own curriculum. Tony mainly focused on running the MSC as a business, and Susan focused on the social and religious aspects. While the church community continued to get more strict, the Alamos found more and more national success, even landing a TV program of their own.
Was it like a show or like a documentary? Or?
Yeah, no, it was a show. Like, they would go on.
On what?
Like reality TV show?
No,
or like
it was like, it was just like preaching. Like all those like TV shows.
Do you think it was like a local like...
Oh, like
channel,
a talk show,
like a PBS
about preaching
type of situation.
Thing?
Yeah, like no, you know, like those, like the evangelical, like
TV
preachers.
I know
that's
what
they
about.
Were. That's what
oh,
they were.
Okay.
They would go on TV like Sunday mornings and preach their sermon all over the nation.
That's crazy.
They would be broadcasted all over the U.S. They were those people. Tony and Susan were getting massively wealthy, and some at the compound were beginning to resent them for their lavish lifestyle. Now, despite their success, 1982 was also when Susan would die, and that seemed to have snapped something in Tony.
It's funny, because the way you said it, that, like, despite their success, Susan died. Like, success keeps you from dying.
Yeah, you don't realize that? Like, when you get a certain amount of money, you're just immortal.
You're untouchable.
That's why when you
like
really
like, Betty White.
Yeah.
Or the Queen.
Yeah, exactly. Like, she's gonna be around forever, the Queen.
Bill Gates will live forever.
Steve Jobs might have died, but has anyone actually seen
Jobs
his body?
Is Steve Jobs actually dead?
Has anyone actually robbed his grave and seen a corpse in there?
Ferb, I know what we're going to do today.
Exactly.
Upon her death, Tony had Susan brought back to the Dyer compound and ordered a marble mausoleum to be built for her.
Question interrupting. How did she die?
I don't know.
Breast
how did
cancer.
She die?
Oh, okay. R.I.P.
Tony was convinced that she would rise from the dead as proof of a miracle and kept her body on display for 2 years.
2 years!
Church members were forced to keep watch over her body, you know, in case she resurrected.
Sprung on up!
And pray for her 24 hours a day. Susan obviously never rose from the dead, and eventually Tony laid her body to rest. Without having a wife now, though, Tony decided that he needed some companionship still, and here's where we get to his child brides.
There it is.
You can't get out of a cult story without child brides.
You just said child and bride in the same sentence.
Sure did.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And we're going to hear it more.
After the death of Susan, Tony married possibly dozens of underage girls, one as young as 8 years old. While he referred to them as his spiritual wives, it was well known throughout the community that he was also raping these girls, as well as drugging and beating them. So, I mean, he had this
raped
great...
an 8-year-old. He was raping an 8-year-old girl.
There are still people that follow him after this. There are still people that follow him to this day.
His churches are still popular in the South. He raped an 8-year-old girl and called her his wife.
Hate to say it, not shocking that it's popular in the South.
I was going to say, the South is a different breed, and I don't mean that endearingly.
No beef if you're from the South,
an inbreed, you will.
But y'all hang out with some whack-ass people. Your neighbor's kind of tripping.
Yeah.
That's not too shocking.
There's one story that even claims that he made one of his child wives get plastic surgery to make her look like Susan.
Oh, that's...
Yeah. Now, that's just kind of hearsay. That wasn't really confirmed, right? That was kind of just like a rumor.
That was one of the accusations like brought against him in criminal proceedings. I only saw that in one document, though. So that is just
that's
a story.
That's not confirmed.
But I wouldn't be too shocked.
Tony was massively wealthy at this point and started spending less time at church, although he still maintained strict control over his followers, making them work 10 to 14 hours a day. Towards the end of the 1980s, some followers had had enough and started reporting their conditions to the government. In 1985, one of them reported their slave-like conditions to the Department of Labor, and suddenly it wasn't so cool to own a Tony Alamo jacket.
That kind of, the branding took a bit of a hit there.
Yeah.
Mm.
The stock just plummeted.
Yeah.
In 1988, two women came forward about the child abuse and sexual assault happening, and this is what eventually took Tony down. Federal agents came to arrest him in 1989, but he fled and managed to escape them for 2 years. It was only after a TV special aired about him that the police were able to locate him in Tampa, Florida, and he was sentenced to 6 years in prison for tax evasion.
I would like to point out real quick, too, while he was in Florida, he wasn't like laying low. He had
a radio show
and everything. Like, he was not being quiet about his existence, but they still somehow didn't manage to find him.
Turn a blind eye, maybe?
Until like they put out a TV special about him, like saying like this is a wanted man, and people were like, "Oh yeah, that's
this
Tony
guy
down the road."
Well,
yeah.
I guess that makes because he was. Wait, no, there was TV then, so you'd think that more people would recognize Tony Alamo, the guy who's wanted by, like, the FBI or something, but...
Yeah. I don't know, though, like, it kind of opened my eyes, like, when we were talking about the last cult that we're going to get to today, the one that's here in Connecticut. Our friend that lives here we were like, "Have you ever heard of this?" And she's like, "No." And this just happened like 2 years ago.
I thought you were going to say she's a part of it. And I'm like,
"Oh, no, God, no."
Well, remember,
but, like, it's really not that well known, I guess, to people who don't run in that circle.
Yeah. And when we were doing the Stockholm Syndrome episode too, there was the girl who was kidnapped. And the only way that people recognized her was they like aired a show about these missing children. And then people were like, "Oh, yeah, I've seen her walking down the street and stuff."
Yeah.
And so they managed to hide in plain sight just by acting like normal people. If you act suspicious and try to lay low, people are going to think that's weird.
Who's that weird guy that I see once a week and he never leaves his house?
But if you're just a friendly neighbor and you have a radio show, you must not have anything to hide.
Yeah.
So people aren't going to be suspicious.
It had been decided that Tony was abusing his tax-exempt status since he obviously was profiting massively off the church. Surprisingly, the child abuse charges were dropped, but don't you worry, they came back.
They did come back.
Thank God.
In 2008, Tony was arrested again in Flagstaff, Arizona, this time for transporting minors across state lines for sex. Big time no-no.
That's rough.
If you do it within one state, it's not as bad, but as soon as you cross that border, oh my God.
Mobile pedophilia, that's a no-no.
This time, Tony got what he deserved and was found guilty on 10 counts and sentenced to 175 years of time in prison, along with owing $500 million to the victims. That's billion with a B. In order to pay this, federal agents started seizing his property and assets, but when they got to many of his properties, they noticed that the buildings had been stripped of anything of value, even the copper wiring. After his sentencing, it was clear that Tony had ordered his followers to take anything of value so that the damages couldn't be paid to the people whose lives he destroyed. So he very obviously, after getting busted, still had massive influence over his followers if he could get them to do that from prison.
He's an actual supervillain.
Yeah.
Why didn't they kill him? I'm sorry. I just like, come on.
On May 2nd, 2017, so very recently, Tony Alamo died in prison in Butner, North Carolina.
There it is.
But the Alamo Foundation continues to operate to this day with thousands of churches all over the southern United States. Emphasis on the southern.
I was going to say 2017. That's just 2 years ago. That's 4 years ago now.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Isn't that also the same year when the Keith got busted?
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
Bro, 2017
big year for cults, 2017
big
was.
Big year, yeah.
Well, it's a big year for ending cults. I wonder
how many. It's a bad year for cults, I guess. I guess so, yeah.
I can't wait till like we're all 30 and all the cults that are going on right now get busted and we're like,
Oh my god, we were in college doing a stupid podcast and this stuff was going on.
McDonald's worker wear owl masks after midnight? That's fucking crazy. I never saw that. Nutty.
All right, we're gonna take a quick break, and when we come back, we're gonna talk about God
who's and Jesus at the same time.
Similar to Nexium, the story of The Work really revolves around one man in particular who manipulated people into believing that he was a god, but really just used his control to exploit them for his own gain. The man in question is Julius Schachnow, who was born to a Jewish family in Brooklyn in 1924 and served in the Navy in World War II. While in the Navy, he converted to Christianity, and when he came back to the United States, his head was filled with ideas of grandeur. He married Elise Bevel upon his return, and they had two children together, but the marriage ended in 1950 when Elise divorced him on the grounds of religious incompatibility.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Was she a Christian and found out that he was actually born a Jew, or like, did they just not have like lining up?
I think what might have happened is she was a normal person, and he was running around going, I'm God! And
that makes
went,
a lot of
no.
sense. That makes a lot of sense.
I can see
I
her
feel like somebody who like actually is a very devout Christian, someone claiming to be God would be pretty disrespectful.
Oh, that's what they call in the religion business blasphemy.
Yeah.
That's what that's called.
They have a name for it, as a matter of fact.
See, I'm not very educated in the ways of the church, so.
Yeah, that's
blasphemy.
Well,
you blasphemy. Were spot on that one. You had a good hunch on it.
Thank
blasphemy
you.
Blasphemy is claiming shit that's bullshit, essentially.
Yeah.
And sacrilegion gotcha. Is like, I think just being a dick.
Yeah.
In paraphrasing stages,
okay.
If you were like, hey, yo, fuck Virgin Mary, like, that's sacrilegious. I didn't actually say that. That was an example. End quote.
So Julius remarried soon after to Mary Smith, the most all-American name ever, besides Susan Alamo. But she, too, divorced him for infidelity in 1960. Around 1970, Julius moved to Trumbull, Connecticut, which is very close to us, by
yeah,
the way.
Yeah, very close.
Where he proclaimed to be Jesus Christ reincarnated.
Of course you gotta come to Connecticut to get away with that lie. Get the fuck out of my face.
What do you mean?
Just like with the Alamos, whack. Julius happened to time his proclamations just right, as the 70s were a time when many people were looking for escapes from reality, and that's what Julius was offering. His preaching was a mix of apocalyptic Christianity, Judaism, and science fiction, which was extremely common for the time. Think of groups like the Alamos and Scientology.
See, that sounds so ridiculous, but like that's what it was.
Yeah. Funny enough, Julius Schachnow and L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of Scientology, share a couple of weird similarities, including their time serving in the Navy during World War II and their fascination with science fiction. After gaining a following of about 100 people, Julius set up a base in Meriden, Connecticut, and he took a bit of a surprising turn.
Is it really that surprising considering what we've been talking about today?
Yes, this is still weird.
Okay,
after
fair enough.
After declaring himself the Messiah, Julius started a construction and real estate company
you know,
called
wouldn't
Countywide
expect it.
Construction.
That is very surprising.
I just find it funny. It's something so mundane, though. It's like it's yeah. nothing flashy like the designer yeah. jackets. It's, he just started a construction
real
company.
Estate and construction.
Gotta start.
He's a good old blue collar man.
Listen,
in
fake,
addition to being Jesus.
Yes.
Fake Jesus, yes. Real humble, yes. Man's got, he's got ground on him. He's like, I'm gonna start from the bottom.
Much like Tony Alamo, Julius heavily exploited his workers, making them work very long hours and paid them well below the minimum wage. Julius ran the business very effectively, though, landing contracts all over central Connecticut and making hundreds of millions of dollars. Of course, it's a lot easier to turn a profit when you're basically using slave labor, but Julius made it work for quite a while. During this boom, Julius met and married Joanne Sweetman, and they had three children together. Joanne became a central figure in the cult. Members called her the Holy Spirit.
So now homie's got five kids?
Yeah, yeah.
What happened to the other two? Did they just peace out for life?
Well, they assuming that his wife, when they got divorced, she took the kids.
But like nothing else came up about the kids or anything?
No,
like,
they had a completely separate life. Never met again.
I mean, it makes sense. But like, can you imagine knowing your dad is out there and all of a sudden he's getting arrested for whack shit?
Culting.
You're
like,
oh, God.
You're like, ooh.
And Joanne, her responsibility was basically keeping tabs on the members while Julius just kind of fucked off and did his own thing most of the time.
Think about this, though. He married Joanne and then made her the central figure of his cult.
Yeah.
And she was like a goddess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty flattering.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's all I got to say about that.
In fact, Julius had given himself a little bit of a promotion while nobody was really paying attention to him. Instead of just being the reincarnation of Jesus Christ, Julius now declared that he was God himself.
How?
So remember how I said he was Jesus and God at the same time? This is what I was referring to.
I mean, I guess, like, that kind of makes sense when you think about it, because the teaching in the church and stuff like that when it comes, like, to Christianity and whatever is that it's like God is three in one person.
Yeah.
It's like the Father, Son, Holy Spirit. So that
But Joanne is the Holy Spirit.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, he's the Father, the Son, and for Halloween, he's going to put a sheet over his head and become the Holy Ghost.
That was pretty good. I'm not going to front. That was good. I was really confused where that was going. I was like, what are you, sheet, ghost, gotcha. I followed the lines.
I made a good joke. Fuck you.
You demoted me. I don't care. But like, that's where I kind of get it. But then I get lost when... Yeah, I feel like you can't really make the claim of just being like, I'm the Messiah, and then all of a sudden you get like, you can't just, you don't evolve into God, I feel like. I feel like you're kind of...
It's like the next Pokemon, yeah, like, evolution. Like,
you don't mutate into the, you know, the Father Almighty. You just kind of are. I feel like, as followers, you'd look at that and be like, hold on a second.
If you're confused by him just being the Messiah and God, just hang in there with me for a second.
I'm confused.
He's got a lot more
that.
Going on.
There were a ton of rules for the members of the work, including not wearing makeup, because that's what whores did, not wearing black, because that's the color of the devil, and that no one was allowed
like
to have sex.
Mother.
That's what whores do!
Tiffany, no, you can't put eyeshadow on. Don't look like a fucking whore.
No one was allowed to have sex in this cult either.
What? Abstinence?
Except, of course, for Julius, who called himself the sinful Messiah because he needed to experience sin so that he knew what it was like.
He just wanted to protect everybody else.
His
so
lambs.
So he's going to fuck everybody for you.
What a sacrifice he's making to
this
better
guy,
his followers.
He's nuts, dude.
Dude, some of these things that people do, I just, I don't even know. Like, just, I got nothing.
As part of being the sinful Messiah and God at the same time, Julius was the only one who was allowed to have sex or take a wife, and boy did he. Julius took up to 7 wives throughout his years in the work, and of course,
wait. Ethan, what are they gonna be?
What are they? His wives?
Wives? Oh, don't make me say it.
What are they?
Child wives.
Oh, they sure are.
They're underage
they
girls.
Are. Why wouldn't they be?
Even more upsetting.
You know, you can keep that in because this is upsetting. This
I'm
is
quite
very,
upsettled right
this
now.
This is very upsetting, the fact that we've had to say child wives in like 3 different increments
God.
Of this episode.
I think I just created the best word ever for this particular topic.
Upsetting.
Even more upsetting, multiple women, including his own stepdaughter, came forward with accusations of being sexually assaulted by Julius when they were children. To excuse all this whack shit that Julius was doing, he claimed that it was God's will that he was to sleep with any woman that he could. So obviously children were fair game, stepdaughter fair game.
Again, this
oh my God.
It was a pretty normal thing actually for cults at the time. With the Branch Davidians, David Koresh was another one of these people who claimed that he was the only one that was supposed to be having sex with people, that he was supposed to like repopulate the earth and everything. And that's like the same kind of thing with Tony Alamo, that they believe that God has given them
the divine right.
Yeah.
And so it's a pretty common thing. But again, it's because these guys are just kind of losers. And they just want to be able to have sex.
They
want to
get as
power.
Much pussy as possible. So they're the only one allowed to get it.
Exactly.
There's no competition.
If only you could do that in like a normal setting where you're just, you know, you're feeling it and you're like,
you want to declare yourself the only man worthy of ween work?
It's like, hey, I, you know, just hot off the presses, I'm the only one that can fuck anybody, and everyone just goes along with it. That'd be fantastic to some extent, obviously. If everyone's like, yeah, that makes sense. Perfect, of course.
Yep.
Now, the manipulation and the abuse, that part doesn't fly, but if that was just like a
kids.
Thing that happened...
We're going to put the kids in there as well. Not a great thing.
I don't count the kids. The kids, they're not... They don't never.
On the religious side of the cult, Julius held multiple six-hour-long sermons a week. Can you believe that? And he was able to spout long verses from the Bible from memory.
He was spitting bars.
So
he was.
If you think about it, if he had put half of the energy and, like, his potential into something worthwhile, he would probably have been a genuinely and morally successful person.
You can kind of say that about everyone. If they
I'm
just all
saying,
went
that's fair.
Path.
My man made a construction and real estate company.
He had to be pretty business
was
savvy
able
to do
just
that.
Spout things from memory for hours on end. Not bad. If he just applied himself like a normal human being, could have seen a pretty successful guy.
I feel like that doubles for Tony Alamo over here, because the man literally sold jackets to famous people.
Yeah.
Like, if he worked for, like, a management corporation or something, you did the chair thing.
I did the chair
Nicole
thing.
Nicole did the chair thing.
Yeah.
Tony Alamo was making those jackets, like, himself before any of, like the forced labor or anything. And so he could have just
He could have just been a self-starter.
Just fine on his own.
If only Etsy was around in the 70s. Ah.
Whoa. At its peak, the work reached about 300 members, but it was about to come crashing down. The entire fate of the cult really rested in the real estate business, and that proved to be a bit of an issue when the 1980s brought a housing crash. Without a major source of revenue and no money to pay any employees, Julius was floundering as people were leaving left and right. After the collapse of his businesses, Julius seemed to just lay pretty low for the rest of his life, and he died on July 30th, 1996 in New Britain, Connecticut. However, that's not quite where the story ends, as the work continued after the death of Julius.
No.
Yeah.
No. I was like, oh, girl, he died in like 2018, and you said 1999, and I said, huh?
No, we've still got like two more pages.
This is the sequel.
Yeah.
The work too.
Oh my
goodness. It's the remix, bitch. A few of the leaders of the group kept things moving, including Joanne Sweetman, her new husband, Paul Sweetman, Rudy Hannon, and Sorek Minery. Rudy and Sorek were pretty close friends, and for months, Rudy tried to convince Sorek to help him kill Paul, claiming that he was beating Joanne and it was God's will for him to die.
Aww.
So remember, to the members of the work, Joanne was practically a goddess, and any harm done to her surely had to be met with retribution.
Uh-huh.
Like, that's their
they
divine
think
figure.
That is, like, legitimately a holy figure. And so what were you going to do if somebody was like laying
some
hands...
douchebag named Paul was beating her up?
Exactly.
You gotta skin him alive. The only reason.
You got it.
You gotta do it to him.
Just God said to. According to Sorek, one day he came home and found Rudy standing over Paul's body, which had been beaten severely with a blunt object. Together, they placed Paul's body in a deep freezer, and the autopsy would later reveal that Paul was still alive after the beating, so he actually froze to death.
Yo, yeah. They put him on ice.
Literally.
Yeah. After
on
some
the
time,
rocks.
After some time, Rudy and Sorek took the body out of the freezer and cut it up with a saw, and then buried parts of it around a local golf course. In 2004, though, a coyote dug up Paul's leg, and so they started an investigation.
What, did they not cut the leg into smaller pieces?
No, so
I guess not.
They only cut it up into a couple of chunks, like the head,
oh,
the
like
torso, like
big
the arms
major
and
chunks.
The legs. So they didn't really do that great of a job.
Why didn't they just? That's an awful thing to say, but I feel like
Ethan?
I feel like they should have just diced him up. Like,
yeah.
If you're gonna do it, do it.
Yeah, just turn him into mulch or something.
Especially like when you find like unidentified human remains, you have to verify they're human first.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people like find bones out in the woods somewhere, and they're like, "Oh my god, this is a body," and then they do testing, and it's definitely not.
It's like a deer. Or a
exactly. So. I mean, if the bones hadn't been identifiable human bones, it would have been a lot harder to prove that that was a crime.
Yeah.
obviously, if it's a dead body on a golf course, it's probably a crime. Yeah. He didn't just die there. It took 12 years for the case to be solved, but eventually enough evidence was collected to arrest them both. Currently, Rudy and Sorek are being held in prison and are awaiting trial.
What happened to the girl Joanne?
She died in the mid-2000s. I think it was 2009, maybe.
R.I.P. Joanne.
Died. Yeah. Oh, Joanne.
Well, that's all for this week. Thank you for listening, everyone. There are a lot of details that we didn't have time to discuss this week, and these cases are really interesting.
Mm.
So if you want to learn more about these stories, there are multiple documentaries and articles out there for you. If you're not following us on social media yet, the fuck are you doing? Genuinely, we say it every episode.
Yeah.
Go do it.
We don't have a cult yet. They're not following yet.
Mm,
we gotta start it up.
We need to be more charismatic and then they'll follow us.
Apparently, yeah.
Do
or
it,
we
you
need to start saying
peasants.
More whack-ass shit.
That's true.
Maybe
I'm
that's
God!
Just start insulting them?
God,
that...
Jesus, and the Holy Ghost.
Yeah,
that's
you're,
the three
you're
of
fucking
us.
Pale enough to be a Holy Ghost, that's for sure.
That's a torch up. Oh
it
my
is.
Goodness.
You guys love to make fun of me on this show.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't do that a lot.
I do.
Homie takes his aggression out
Listen,
on me.
Listen, last week,
Paul.
You said that my titties would start a recycling initiative. They were.
I did?
Yes.
When?
Well,
for
you
what?
Guys were both fighting
that was
me up for it. It was
I'll
kind
take...
of a joint effort.
Was that yeah. in the episode?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I don't remember.
Remember
that at
Lola Montez and her titties?
Yeah. No, I do. Yeah. Okay.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Rule of Three, 333 on Instagram. Rule 3 Podcast on Facebook. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and goodbye.
See you next
Bye-bye.
Week.
Bye-bye.